This is GamesAtWork.biz with your hosts, Phaedra Buenaderos, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, not of any organization with which we have been, are, or will be affiliated. This is episode 19, Now Playing Seriously, brought to you by the letters B, U, and the number 34,969.
Hello and welcome to yet another edition of Playing Games at Work, or GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin. I'm coming to you live from the big terrace here in Budapest, Hungary. And I'm very, very excited to be here with my co-host, Phaedra Buenaderos, coming to us live out of North Carolina. Hi, Phaedra.
Hey, Michael. How are you today?
I'm doing terrific. Bright blue skies, and it's a gorgeous day. I hope it is with you at home, too.
Rain.
Oh, no way. Really? Well, and we have someone who's extra special on the show with us today, someone that we've recently met and we're delighted to have on the podcast. Gwen Gordon is with us from all the way on the west coast of the United States in California. Gwen, welcome.
Thank you. Hi. It's good to be here.
Well, we're so delighted to have you. I've been reading your body of work, and I've been looking at your Kickstarter piece of work, and you're seriously a movie. But before we even get to that, the thing that got me really excited, and my kids, by the way, really excited, was your work with the Muppets. So the first question right out of the gate is, can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to work with Muppets, what you personally did, and did you ever, you know, get a chance to really spend a lot of time with Jim Henson?
Right. This is really what everybody wants to talk about.
Well, that's where we start, right?
It's like, I was 19 years old when I started working there, and I got the job because I had heard that they were starting to make movies, and a friend of mine's mother was Miss Piggy's costume designer, and she said they needed help. So I made my first puppet. It was a crocheted bird, and I sent the bird, Clive, as if he were applying for the job and talking endlessly in his little note about Big Bird. And anyway, and that he was willing to re-nest. So at 19, I took some time off from college and jumped into the Henson playground, and as you know, initially as an apprentice, and started doing the basic Muppet grunt work, which was cleaning eyeballs and, you know, stitching seams back together. And there were like drawers full of eyes and noses and various body parts. And so I was a basic maintenance person. But there were only four people on who worked on Sesame Street. And I started in the summer when they were still making Muppets Take Manhattan, and I helped to make some fish for the big theater scene.
Oh, cool.
Where they do fish. And then when the season started, I was hired for that. And and it was a lot of fun. It was really, you know, an incredible adventure for a 19-year-old. And I got a really great opportunity right out of the gate, because with Sesame Street, you basically just got a couple of scripts, the scripts for the week, and you'd read through and see what was needed. And, you know, oftentimes there are just things completely out of the blue, like a nose flute for Snuffleupagus or a basketball court for Slimy the Worm. And we would just have to invent it, you know, figure out, you know, there is no place to find out how to make a nose flute for Snuffleupagus. So you just took what was there and over again had to just figure out how to solve problems with whatever you had. So it was great training for just, you know, really creating from scratch and just improvising. And so I was very lucky, because my first season I got to invent some characters. There were some new characters every season, and my first season was the Rockheads. And everybody would in the workshop in the Henson in the Sesame Street side, the four of us would offer designs, and then they would get chosen by Michael Frith, whichever ones he wanted, and mine were chosen.
So Phaedra, do you have a special Muppet that has a special place in your heart?
Oh boy, that's a very difficult one. There are so many that I absolutely adored. Maybe Snuffleupagus. You know, those big eyelashes that just did it every time.
I was actually a big fan of Fraggle Rock, too. I hate to admit it. And I spent some time actually writing the music to the Fraggle Rock song for clarinet. I still have that somewhere.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
How's it go again?
I could sing it, but then it'll be recorded here.
Exactly.
Yeah, nice try, Gwen. I like you already. So, Phaedra, I think you had a question or two you wanted to throw Gwen's way.
I did. I was looking at your videos for the movie that you're making, Seriously, the Kickstarter. And I was just fascinated by the people you were interviewing and their wide range of definitions of play. Mm-hmm. So I was just curious, Gwen, which of all of those definitions of play was your absolute favorite? Which really resonated for you and made you pause?
Oh, funny. Let me think. You know, I really loved the one that I included with Barry Sanders, who you don't really see it in the trailer, but he's basically just citing the Oxford English Dictionary. One of the first definitions is to pay attention, which, you know, is quite stunning. You know, it begs the question, well, what are the roots and how did it get there? And because most of us think of play as just high engagement. And so what I loved about that was that it was unexpected. And so it makes you pay attention. And it also, because, you know, probably one of the things that I've learned after this decade of really inquiring deeply into what the nature of play and, is that paying attention and being present, you know, the moment is the doorway, the only doorway to the playground. So I really loved that one.
I also remember the comment about serial murderers. Serial murderers don't play. I thought that was interesting.
Well, you know, when I listened to that particular quote, too, you know, Phaedra, who I thought about was Chris Hazard.
As a serial murderer?
No. As a definition of playing games. So,
oh.
Because Chris Hazard is a software developer, Gwen, and actually a friend of both Phaedra and mine. And he has a very similar definition there, too, that when you're playing a game, you are surprised by what happens in the game, and that surprise provides a learning opportunity and a chance for engagement you just wouldn't have had otherwise.
Yeah.
And that, I think, couples very nicely with the Sanders quote there, too, that you're very much in the moment, right? The whole Zen and motorcycle maintenance, you're right there when you're playing and you're engaged.
Yeah. Yeah, and what's great is that, in fact, I don't know if you know Mark Beckoff's work. He's the animal biologist, evolutionary biologist, animal behavior person. He basically saw they were looking at some of the real evolutionary reasons, purposes for play, if there had to be one, which a lot of people are really committed to finding. And what he saw after, I mean, really rigorous research, was that play seems to prepare us, seems to create the context in which the unexpected, the surprise, is safe. Mm-hmm. So it prepares us. It creates a wider repertoire of responses so that we're better able to deal with the unexpected. Because it's pleasurable in play. It's like we like that. We don't want to know what's going to happen next, actually. Most of us think we do. You know, most of us live with a kind of terror of the unexpected. But in play, it's exactly the opposite. We want to be surprised. We love being surprised. So it actually helps us, you know, in an evolutionary perspective, that's a really good thing to like. Because actually, it is all unexpected. Most, you know. Life don't have control. So to have some wiring that has us actually enjoy that, and then an activity that is so pleasurable, that, you know, play that helps us actually learn how to respond effectively to the unexpected, that's a really strong evolutionary case for play.
So with that in mind, and I guess it is kind of unexpected, right? How many movies have you made before, Gwen, just out of curiosity?
Documentaries? This is my first feature-length documentary, and I have, I've, you know, produced a lot of little videos, children. I had a little production company, did some work for children in hospitals, and produced one short documentary. But this is the first.
So it's new, but you have some ideas about it. What led you to say, you know what, I need to make a movie? What would you say is like the key time when you woke up and said, I've got to do this?
Oh, it's funny. There really was a moment. It's rare that there's a story. But yeah, so I'd been, you know, as you know, from my background, just immersed as a creative in lots of projects, had a lot of my own, but was just sitting in the creative saddle for the first half of my life. And then something happened where I started to really, I did the research at, studied at CIS and got a degree in philosophy. And I basically started to, you know, in the inquiry around play, started to look at applying it to other people's projects and to the world, to you know, a sphere that was much wider than one that I could create myself. So I was really interested in being a consultant, and I spent 5 years applying play principles that I'd learned about on other people's projects. And it kind of, you know, like any path, you can kind of get down the road and then you forgot like, oh wait, this isn't the kind of animal I am. It was like, that was really interesting, but wait. And at a certain point, you know, I was working on other people's film projects, a lot of film projects, and I started to realize that I actually was, you know, doing the bricklaying, creating engagement campaigns, applying play to the kind of ongoing ways people could apply, you know, big ideas that were introduced in film into their lives and world and play with them. And I realized I was tired of working on other people's films. It was that feeling of, wait, I have a film to make. And then I was on the phone with a friend who's a filmmaker, and he had been basically making really films about very difficult and depressing topics. And he said, Gwen, I'm sick of making depressing films about Lyme disease and the spoils of war. And I said, Andy, I'm sick of working on other people's projects. You know, I'm starting to hate my clients, which is a really bad sign. And so we had this moment of, you know, chocolate meets peanut butter. Let's make a film about play. And I, you know, it was like something kind of got released. It was in that moment where we both said that, you know, that had that recognition that we could work together and do something that we both wanted to do. It was like, you know, it was just this like huge relief. And within 9 hours, Michael, it was really an incredible feedback loop. That was in the evening on a Thursday. The next morning, I'm sitting at a conference and I end up just, you know, synchronistically sitting next to an old funder of mine who's a Rockefeller sister. And she had funded a project 15 years before and we'd stayed in touch. And she said, Gwen, I was just thinking about you. What are you up to?
How's that for serendipity, huh?
Yeah, kind of amazing. So I told her I was, you know, I'd been thinking I might make a movie about play, and she said, let me be the first to fund you. So there was no time for me to argue. So that was it. I was just tired of working in other people's projects. I knew there was a creative, you know, seed in me. I knew it was a film. I had already written 8 chapters of a book, and I kind of knew that it wanted to be a film instead of a book. It was short. I had to do another 6 months of completing client work, and then I could follow up on the funding offer. And that last September, I stopped working on other projects and just jumped into Seriously.
Have you raised all the funding you need so far, or are you still looking for donations?
Well, you know, it's a great question, Phaedra. You know, it's when working on a film, getting the first piece of funding, it's great. You know, I got to make a trailer, and then I realized I'd really just gotten, it was a stroll in the park. The funding, it came easily at first. I got 3 grants. I shared the first clip that I made in January, and it went viral. And 3 weeks later, 35,000 people had seen it, and I'd gotten $18,000 in additional donations and it from just private people. It was just a phenomenal start for me, you know, just as a first filmmaker. And then I realized, wow, you know, I thought I was, you know, really getting a good clip going, a pace. And happened was I was really just sitting at base camp, and I looked up and the clouds parted. It was sort of a cinematic moment. And there was Mount Kilimanjaro behind me. And I was sitting on the bench, you know, wearing ballet slippers. So I realized I had a big trek fundraising ahead of me, and that I really needed to gear up and either learn how to dance up a mountain or, you know, or get some new shoes. So to answer your question, I have a lot more to raise. For this, what this project really looks like it wants to be is more of a series, because it's going to start as a feature-length film, an hour, which is a short feature-length film, but it's still technically. And that will be a pilot for a series called Now Playing, where each of the episodes, each of the segments will be a focus on different area of life. So now playing at work, now playing at home, now playing in school, now playing for life, which would be health and wellness, now playing for the future, which would be innovation and creativity, and now playing for change, which would be social justice. So I'm, gearing up for a really, significant amount of fundraising. And that's why this Kickstarter campaign, is really just a transitional fund so that we can get the package ready that can attract some real sponsors. And, it has huge potential. So this is the very first step.
So Gwen, how are you finding that you're applying the power of play to your fundraising? I mean, I think your videos kind of are a good element there. How else are you applying play to forward this this project, move this project forward?
So there are two answers to that. One is, of course, everything about this project, if it's not playful, we're missing the point. So, mm-hmm. So as you've seen in the fun, in the Kickstarter clip, and anybody who goes there,
you're in a box.
I'm in a box. Garbanzo, the fearless wonder pug. And, we're occupying Kickstarter, and we're not going to leave until we raise at least $25,000. So it's obviously a playful conceit. And we've also got a mid-campaign Dance Where You Are Day on September 18th, where we're inviting people to dance wherever they are at noon and make a video. And the person who's attracted the most people to dance with them gets a signed case of dill pickles and a DVD. And the person who's most creative gets, of course, a gold tiara and a 80s disco ball pendant. We're trying to get people to play as we go. And my updates for if you do pledge, then you'll get updates from Inside the Box, my video blog. And we have a game trivia question each week. And you can ask me questions from Inside the Box. And, the slogan for me is sometimes it takes getting really an inside a box in order to make something really big and outside the box. So obviously, the whole deal is that this is play, and every step of the way is going to be play. And if we're not having fun, and if I'm not, really enjoying the people I'm working with, we have 8 volunteers ranging from high school student to a retired military officer. And we meet in the afternoons at a cafe, and we have some friendly competitions, and someone always has bubbles. And so, we're playing. And at the same time, that's the sort of official answer. And at the same time, I am definitely, a workaholic. And I am teaching what I need to learn most. And so I have, a tendency to work crazy hours. So what I'm trying to do, I had a whole series of play sparks that I tried to invite myself and others to do with me that would keep me playing. And I'm also, I've got someone that I call sort of like a 12-step program, a sponsor that I call every day, make sure that I'm not overdoing it. And I have people who help me with interventions. So I'm actually really in the laboratory of how to be really serious about a project and be delightfully absorbed and be doing the work that I love and watch it before I cross the line. There's always a line where your body is basically saying, have you eaten? Wouldn't it be nice to move? I don't want to go out. Don't you want to, you know, getting up would be a really good idea about now. And you ignore it. And I'm a master at ignoring it. So I'm, you know, really trying to make, you know, a project like this where there's nobody else standing over my shoulder and it's my own darn compulsion that's keeping me going. I'm doing my best to learn what I need to learn in order to create the balance that I hope to be able to, you know, inspire other people to keep.
Gwen, what sprung to mind is if when your project, you know, hits the airwaves and you've got the Now Playing series fully engaged, when you visualize the future and your impact on the world, what would you see as the best possible outcome?
So, you know, I meet a lot of people who have a hunch. Most of the people that I've interviewed just on the street, when I do person on the street interviews, you know, it might be because they know I'm making a film about play that they'll answer the question, you know, whether play important to you. They'll say yes. But then almost every one of them, I ask, well, do you play enough? And they say no. And so there's some big gap there, you know, that for the people who actually do at least consciously think that play is important, we're not playing enough. And then there are the other people who don't even, you know, give it a thought. It's sort of like just taken for granted that it's something for children, you know, if at all, children in their spare time, that it's not integral to learning, that it's not essential to life, that it's marginal, frivolous, you know, a distraction from the serious business of life. And so, you know, they're definitely not going to be playing much. And then there are the people who, you know, for whom play is really just a pressure relief from their, you know, the gray box of their own play deprived lives. And they'll do it, you know, play hard in the evening or on weekends in, you know, really sort of ways that aren't necessarily life enhancing, let's just say. So I, you know, there's a lot of symptoms of play deprivation, not to mention, I mean, I could go on and on, but so for the film, if the film were to be a complete success, first of all, the sort of interim step would be, it'd be something for people to point to. It'd be that irrefutable case that just addresses, preempts everybody's resistance and just, you know, shines a light on play so that we understand it is integral, that it dignifies, it elevates it to, you know, even to a spiritual path even. I mean, I'm actually not exaggerating. This isn't hyperbole. I think play is so essential to our evolution that for us to see a movie that takes a topic that is sort of like, you know, that we take for granted, that's like, you know, when I say play, people are often like, what do you mean? I mean, you know, gamification and the work that you're studying is much more understandable as, well, a strategy for getting people to do things. But play in general, you know, as a broader topic, just isn't recognized as a legitimate area of even study. So to take that and elevate it and bring it, shine the light on it, make it important again, make it vital, it gives people something to point to, you know, to make a case for bringing play to other environments. I want it to be the case for play that's itself irresistible. I mean, there are books and there's a series in 96, and it's not the first time this is happening, of course, but I really hope that this one will be really, you know, just something that's just so much fun to watch that also makes this really strong case and becomes a public conversation about the power of play, so that eventually play's back in the center of our lives and we're listening to our, I mean, in some sense, it's really, we're so wired for play. It is our true nature. We have more resources available to us. We have the genius. We have the ability to collaborate. We have the intelligence, the creativity that we need at this time. You know, the problems that we're facing. Plus, we have the love for life that helps us stay in the game. You know, a lot of us are just sort of half here, letting, you know, all these watching from the sidelines. Well, a lot of really disheartening and dangerous things are happening. So my hope is that bringing play into, you know, dignifying play and having people remember that their lives can be play is part of a continuum that has people engage more fully in every arena and bring their full resources to bear. And I'm realizing it sounds very, very grandiose, you know, but this, you gotta, if you're gonna raise the money to make a big film and then create a series and put your whole, you know, everything you've got, I've got everything at stake in this, you gotta believe it's important.
With all of the interviews that you've done, all of the different kinds of people, the different ethnicities, the two genders, the different age groups, do you have a sense that there's some kind of a breakout in terms of who's more predisposed towards embracing this notion of play and who isn't? What have you noticed? For example, you know, it struck me, I don't know if you pronounce it Qigong master, you know, one of the folks that you interviewed who is Asian, talking about play and using these, you know, big arm movements and saying it's starting something new. I was just curious, you know, if you could talk a little bit about whether you've noticed any groups of thought.
You know, other than, of course, children. Mm-hmm. The people that I see, what's fascinating is to see how many different types of groups are really interested in play, and they have slightly different understandings of it. I mean, for instance, even you guys are interested in the gaming technologies at work. Now, that's a very interesting little niche. You know, I'm standing at about 1,000 feet altitude, looking at play from so many different angles. And so that's, you know, this is interesting to see people who are within organizations who are trying to make make organizations more fun, but at the same time more productive. That's a very specific type of person that's different from, of course, a Qigong master. You know, and then we've got the neo-tribal movement and all the, you know, Burning Man and Wanderlust and, you know, the various festivals that are burgeoning, you know, there's more and more. That's a very different type of person. Then, you know, of course, the U.S. Play Coalition is a group of people that largely come from, you know, national parks and rec. And for them, play is movement outside. And that's a different kind of person. We've got the Maker Faire movement, which is, you know, the playful geeks who are, you know, DIY movement. That's a different, it's fascinating. And then, you know, then there's sort of the philosophical cosmologists who are seeing, you know, sort of at a higher altitude or seeing the higher principles of play. And that's a different type of person. So I can't answer really the question. It's amazing to see, you know, you've got sports, you've got dancers, you've got artists, you've got, I mean, play is so broad that to see, you know, when I start to look at, well, who am I talking to? And I start to meet the people and they're responding, you know, I'm meeting early childhood ed people and sand tray therapists. And then on the other side, you know, completely talking to someone in the bowels of Microsoft about gamifying testing. And it's an amazing array. I mean, it's truly amazing to see. And there, so it's, you know, it would sound like, well, everybody's interested in play, but they're a thin layer. You know, it's a rare person at Microsoft, of course, who's interested in play. So we're seeing, you know, play is kind of poking through the cracks in a lot of different turf. You know, and I guess, you know, a simpler answer to your question would be that there are people who have a natural, you know, just their own personality is naturally oriented toward joy. And we know that there's some people who are just more playful. And it's hard to say, you know, what it is about them. But, you know, in any field, they're going to be the ones who are really interested in what we're doing and want to be the kind of ambassadors.
So Gwen, as we kind of wind down, the one thing that maybe it will be interesting to kind of hear your thoughts on is the word seriously. You know, Ian Bogost, when he was with us last week, you know, talked about his use of the word seriously, like, you know, that's a serious piece of cheesecake. Serious games has certainly been dissected a multitude of different ways. So when you chose to have seriously as an important part of your movie title, share with us a little bit about what you were thinking and why you chose that word.
So I think I started out playing with titles like Serious Delight or I was just wanting to offset some of the sense of frivolity that words around play generally have. So I was, you know, and there's also a kind of cultural meme around, well, seriously, really? That I wanted to play with. And, you know, just to again, bring in something unexpected. And, you know, people often say, well, Gwen's, you know, doing a serious about play. And it is a kind of contradiction to hold that, you know, that's why we're that there are really life-changing and important and things with gravity, you know, some real reasons, high impact that play has. I have to say it's a working title, so I'm not at all committed to it. And a lot of people have a hard time remembering it, so I'm actually leaning toward changing it to Now Playing. And we'll probably do that after the Kickstarter campaign. But it is, you know, people do see it as a playful title, you know, seriously, a movie about play. But I think you're asking a question that's less about just branding and more about
Well, language is so important all the time. I mean, people, you know, build in a lot for one particular word. And I love Now Playing. I can see, you know, like a movie theater marquee that says Now Playing, you know, and black letters, and then the red would be, you know, your other title, stuff like that. I love those images.
Yeah. And I can't wait to hear, like, coming soon, Now Playing.
Yeah.
Or Now Playing.
Well, Gwen, Fader and I are, like I said, super delighted that we had a chance to spend a little bit of time here with you on the show and sharing with all of our audience all of your thoughts about play. We'll be watching your Kickstarter intently. Well, I know I'm going to subscribe so I can get the in-the-box blog post from you and Garbanzo, if Garbanzo decides to write or bark something as well. I just want to say thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much. I know it's a lot of fun to share the ideas about play that often come out through other people's mouths in the film, so it's nice to be able to talk about it myself. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Gwen. We can't wait to see your movie, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Yes, we know it'll be a big success.
Thanks so much. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and you can follow us at Twitter at GamesAtWork_BIZ. We'd like to thank the guys at Zebes Systems for their rocking version of the Moon Patrol game theme.